Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I'm so excited to be on tonight and talking with you all. We have a great special guest, Dr. Ron Leifer, who I believe will be joining us momentarily. And I want to remind people that we're going to talk for a little while and then open up the lines for you to call in. And so if you're going to want to call in, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167, 267-521-0167. And as always, you might want to grab a pen and paper because there's probably going to be lots of really good information that will be shared throughout the show that you want to keep on, and that you can always listen to this in its archive form on Blog Talk Radio in the future. And so I believe that Dr. Ron Leifer, your line should be open. And we just lost you there for a second. So hopefully that you will come back in, 267-521-0167, and we will be patching in Dr. Ron Leifer in just a moment. So for those of you who don't know, Ron's a psychiatrist, and I'm reading off of this blog about the life and work of Ron Leifer on ronleifer.zenfactor.org. And there we go. Hi, Dr. Ron Leifer, are you with us?
Hello?
Hello.
Hello, Laura.
Yes, hi.
Is this
Ron, are you there?
This is Ron Leifer.
Hello, thank you so much for joining us tonight. How are you?
Well, I want to tell you, I'm 82 years old and my hearing is not great. So I hope I can hear your questions, but I've got somebody here to help me.
Okay, great. And what's that person's name, if they're wanting to join in?
My name.
Great.
She asked my name.
Aini. Aini is sitting next to me, ready to help if I need her.
Hi, Heidi. Thanks for joining in. So, Dr. Leifer, would you tell us a little bit about who you are and what your ideas about psychiatry are, and how you, for more than 50 years, have been working in this field in the way that you do?
She asked if you could tell a little bit about yourself and your ideas of psychiatry.
Well, I've been practicing non-coercive, non-medical psychotherapy for 50 years. I'm retired. But I was trained at Syracuse. Tom Zoster is my mentor. And after I finished my training, he and I were close friends for 50 years until he died. And I've also had extensive training in meditation and Buddhist philosophy. I trained with Tibetan lamas, and I've merged Buddhism and Western psychology and philosophy into my view of human suffering and its relief.
Wow, that's amazing. So I did do a little bit of looking around on this on the ronleifer.zenfactor blog, and so it talked about your work with Thomas Szasz and what you did to defend him all the way back in the 1960s when his book was first coming out, The Myth of Mental Illness, in 1961. Could you tell people who A, may not know who Szasz was and why there was a controversy, and what the whole idea of your perspective of non-coercive psychotherapy is about?
Okay. Could you say that question, the end of it, one more time, please?
Tom Joshua was a leading critic of psychiatry. He wrote a book called The Myth of Mental Illness in 1961, which created a lot of stir and discussion. And in that book, he denies the reality of mental illness. It's not an illness like diabetes or thyroid disease. Mental illness is a metaphor which medicalizes human suffering.
And it still causes a lot of controversy, right?
Still causes a lot of controversy.
So you were at the Upstate Medical Center in Syracuse. You were teaching there. You were in school there. You were
at Upstate. And what were you doing, in school or teaching? When you were at Upstate, were you in school or teaching?
Both. I was at Upstate. I was on the faculty of psychiatry, and I also took a master's degree in philosophy at Syracuse University.
Okay. So, because I read that it was you and Ernest Becker who wrote The Denial of Death, right? Which is another, these were the people that you were surrounded with in the early days of your career, or in you're already well into your career at this point, when you got to be around these people, in terms of that, and that the controversy was right where you were. And you were involved with it.
The time that you wrote the book with Ernest Becker, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Just that you were in the midst of this major piece of history. How it affected you, and how you see this.
You're talking a little too loud. Excuse me.
During the time when you and Ernest wrote the book, The Denial of Death, that was a very point in your life.
I know. No, the translation's a little rough. Is my tone of voice okay here now?
Can you hear her now? Hang on, one second. Okay, try now.
Okay. I know that Becker wrote The Denial of Death. You didn't. I'm just, from the perspective of it being a really important piece of time in history, and that you were there in the midst of it, and how did it affect you in coming to your stance on non-coercive psychotherapy?
How did that time when that book came out, and you were surrounded with those
Which
people?
The Myth of Mental Illness.
The Myth of Mental Illness. How did it affect you?
Well, it just impressed me with Becker's literary competence and his knowledge. It didn't affect me emotionally, because being a student of a Tibetan Lama's, death is a very big issue. When I first met a Tibetan Lama, the first thing he said to me was, either you're going to die before your mother or your mother's going to die before you. So they're very death-oriented. So from my Buddhist training, I was not in denial of death. I could look at it as a profound insight into human psychology, but it didn't affect me personally.
Right, that was Becker's book. But what about the Myth of Mental Illness? Did you, prior to the controversy with SAS, did you, how did you develop your stance on non-coercive psychology, psychotherapy?
How did you develop your stance on non-coercive psychiatry?
On what?
Non-coercive psychiatry.
Well, by spending a lot of time in mental hospitals and seeing how cruel psychiatrists were to the patients. That turned my stomach.
I know it's emotionally upsetting, but I'm wondering if you would be able to just inform people. You have such a wealth of history. Can you tell people what it was like back then, what you witnessed, what was going on, and how it's either the same or different today?
What did you witness back then, and how has it changed today?
Well, I witnessed, for example, a woman being brought in by her husband with her hands tied behind her back because she wouldn't do what he wanted. And people having their licenses taken away, their civil rights taken away, and basically imprisoned in places called psychiatric hospitals, having drugs forced on them that caused very disabling side effects like Parkinsonism. And I saw psychiatry harming people with drugs. And C.S. Lewis said, of all the tyrannies, the sincere effort to help somebody who doesn't want it is the most oppressive of all. So I witnessed the oppression of the patients by the psychiatrists. And this was a time when the civil rights movement was on, and I was very active in that. So freedom was in the air. Also, the anti-war movement, I was a part of that. And my father was a very big influence on me. He believed in freedom, and he taught me that. So from my early days, I was a believer in personal freedom and an antagonist to the power of the state. My father was that way, I'm that way. Psychiatry just confirmed to me the rightness of that stance.
I'm just taking in what you're saying, and you mentioned so many things, but an antagonist to the state. As somebody, I guess, who shares that value, I can only imagine what it was like in the 60s and going through as the civil rights movement was developing and being there. I was born in 72, so I missed a lot, right, in terms of what happened. But I know, and a lot of what my research showed, and I've used SAS. I mean, part of why it's such an honor to talk with you is because of your work and your place in history. And I know that you were an award winner for outstanding contributions to the cause of civil liberties, the Thomas SAS Award. And I just, you know, what my research showed was that when people speak out against psychiatry, that they're retaliated against. And so to have read this story, which I didn't, of your life, through this website, which I didn't know when I was doing the research, it just amazes me that even you as a professor and student there, that and Saz as a professor there, that he experienced kickback in that kind of way. And as a very young academic myself, I've been adjuncting for 10 years, I just really appreciate the stances that you've taken. And so can you talk a little bit more about what antagonist to the state is about and how psychiatry is involved in that?
Could you repeat that question one more time?
About what being an antagonist to the state is about and how psychiatry is involved in that. Could you talk a little more about that?
What is being an antagonist to the state? Explain that. And
the what?
An antagonist to the state?
An anxiety state?
Okay. Antagonist?
No. How is being an antagonist? What is it?
To the state, to the government.
He's asking to explain it, right?
Yeah. How, for you, and how psychiatry interacts with that, how psychiatry, why to speak out against psychiatry.
Okay. Being an antagonist, what is that about? Okay. And how does it affect psychiatry?
Well, if you have human freedom, you can't be an advocate of psychiatry. Psychiatry is an opponent of human freedom because psychiatry runs places called hospitals where people have lost their freedom and they're just subject to psychiatric authority. People don't realize it's still true today how much power psychiatrists have and how they oppress the people they're supposed to be helping.
What kind of power?
What kind of power?
They have the power of society backing them up. Look, psychiatry is, in my opinion, it's not a branch of medicine. It's a branch of Homeland Security.
Huh.
The function of psychiatry is social control. What else could it be when it imprisons people in locked wards and controls them? That's social control, not medicine. Psychiatry is a social institution disguised as a medical specialty. It's disguised because if it wasn't disguised with a medical model, its activities would clearly be unconstitutional and ethically repugnant.
Yeah, unconstitutional. And, of course, those of us who are fighting against any kind of involuntary psychiatry imposed by the state or any uninformed psychiatry that anybody might, with thinking that they're giving consent, that all of that be abolished. And I loved one of the statements around repugnant and unethical. And I think that's so much of what this is. For 50 years, you've been working to try to educate people and writing books. What do you want to tell people?
For 50 years, you've been working and writing books. What do you want to tell people?
Don't believe everything the experts say. Psychiatrists are liars. There is mental illness is a metaphor, and it's used to justify controlling people. Unless voluntary psychiatry, voluntary psychotherapy is okay.
What do you say? We get a lot of response that people don't buy it. It's not a rights violation. Congressman Murphy or whoever who's trying to pass these oppressive laws. What would you say to these people in these hearings about psychiatry who are with state power creating these laws?
What would you say to the people who don't agree with you in the state who are trying to pass oppressive laws? What would you say to them?
Okay.
A congressman or a senator who opposes your view and is passing oppressive laws. What would you say to them?
Look at what you're passing, but don't look at it as medical, and don't look at what you're doing as treating mental illness. Look at it just as you're controlling people, and then see if you want to still boast about how this is a free country.
Right. How is there any freedom when people are being forced into psychiatry? And so another thing that, I mean, we have a lot of time to talk, and I know that there are people on the line listening in already who may want to come in and ask questions with you. But I also want to talk about your the other side of your work and around your work around Buddhism and the Western psychiatry and Buddhist psychology. And the books are around that you've worked on also to let people know just some alternative ideas about the way we could be thinking about the world as opposed to the way psychiatry is trying to control people about it. So would you talk a little bit about your how you became a Buddhist practitioner and what that means?
Sure.
How did you become a Buddhist practitioner?
Well, in 1964, I had a friend who was a Hindu monk who taught me meditation, and I studied with him for 18 years, and then he advised me to get a Buddhist teacher, so So I went to a Buddhist monastery and got a Tibetan Lama as a teacher. And the main point is that Buddhism is focused on the relief of human suffering and not the common ground with psychiatry. Except Buddhists don't use the term mental illness. They have another way of viewing human suffering in non-medical terms. Namely, that our suffering is caused by desires that we can't satisfy, aversions that we can't avoid, and so we're living frustrated, anxious, angry, and depressed. And that's non-medical. That's just a human condition. And Buddhism addresses that by helping people to understand the nature of their suffering and the way out of suffering. That's what Buddha was all about.
It sounds really interesting, and in terms of how it acknowledges these human experiences as suffering, and that suffering is okay. Then, I mean, if somebody was to come after never having been exposed to this to you, and has some trouble getting it, getting even the idea of meditation or something like that, what would you say to them?
Someone come to you and they had a hard time getting it and didn't understand meditation, how would you talk to them?
I would explain that meditation is basically becoming familiar with how the mind works, because suffering is a state of mind, happiness is a state of mind. So if you understand the mind, you're able to manage your mind so that you can create states of happiness without drugs.
And so that's a key part of it. Just out of curiosity, do you know what happiness is?
He said, just out of curiosity, do you know what happiness is?
Well, I have my own definition of it.
Beautiful. I think that's one
happiness,
of the...
Happiness is not what Americans think it is, namely getting everything you want. It's not he who dies with the most toys wins. That's not happiness. Happiness, from a spiritual point of view, is a calm, tranquil mind that understands the nature of reality and is able to face reality with a calm and intelligent mind.
Right, and you have a book, The Happiness Project, right? So you've spent a lot of time thinking about this. Would you talk about that book?
Yeah, that was my first of three books called The Happiness Trio. The Happiness Project is the idea, which is somewhat drawn from Becker, that people need to feel that they can be happy in the future in order to be happy in the present. If you feel you're not going to be happy in the future, you get depressed. So everybody has a happiness project. It may be getting rich. It may be falling in love. It may be having a family. It may be displaying one's talent to others and being appreciated. But whatever our happiness project is, that's what we'll suffer from. If we think a lot of money will make us happy, we'll suffer from money problems. If we think that love will make us happy, we'll suffer from love problems. So we're caught in a dilemma. We need to feel that we can be happy in the future, but our desire to be happy in the future is what causes our anxiety and our depression, when we feel that we can't be happy in the future. When people feel that they can't be happy in the future, they feel there's nothing to live for, and that's when they become depressed and possibly suicidal.
Yeah. Which, of course, is one of the reasons why they think it's perfectly fine to lock us away and drug us, ironically, right? And so, you know, it's a big, that's just such a profound kind of way of looking at it, and you explain that so well, that if you have an expectation about something, whatever that expectation is going to cause you problems. Because it's never going to meet or be what it is you think it is, right? Is that? So if there's no expectations, you eliminate a lot of your potential disappointment.
If you don't have any expectations, you avoid the
disappointment.
Yes.
Expectation means disappointment.
Yeah.
Low self-esteem is really disappointment with oneself, that we all have expectations and wishes of what we want ourselves to be, and we have a hard time living up to our own ideals for ourselves. And then if we can't live up to them, our sense of our own value goes down. We suffer from low self-esteem.
Yeah, it just makes so much sense. And there are so many things I want to ask you about, because you've done so many things over the years. Would you talk about the Foucault Tribunal on the state of psychiatry?
The Foucault Tribunal was a mock trial organized by survivors of psychiatry in Germany. It took place in Berlin. Tom Zuss was the first prosecuting attorney, and the second Foucault Tribunal, he couldn't make, so he asked me to take his place, and I served as the prosecuting attorney, prosecuting psychiatry for being coercive, for being illogical, for harming people, and for functioning as a social institution of social control. And then there were what they called a nut box of jurors and there were psychiatrists on the other side. So it was like a mock trial with, I was the prosecutor, then there were psychiatrists who defended the profession, and then there were a jury of ex-mental patients who made a judgment, and their judgment was that psychiatry is a coercive institution.
That's wonderful. How brilliant. I'm just thinking from a standpoint of social commentary, and how, when you look at today, the mental health courts today and how they're used, what a brilliant turn it all around on them kind of thing that was. Can you talk more about how, because people say all of the time that anybody who is opposed to psychiatry is wrong. And how do you make that rebuttal to them? What were some of the things that, as the prosecutor, you said?
Psychiatry is not a science. The medical model is not a fact. We don't discover the medical model. The medical model is a metaphor that we use to explain human suffering and describe and name human suffering as if it's a medical disease.
And yet you have these lawmakers who are getting up saying it's a brain disease to society and getting away with it. How does that happen?
That's the problem. Psychiatrists have turned into what I call brainiacs. They think that mental illnesses are caused by brain disease, but they don't have one single fact to back that up. They just make it up because it makes them look like doctors. And the problem is that the language of the brain is the language of neural transmissions, and you can measure them. The brain is a solid object, and the language of consciousness is the language of purpose and meaning, so you can't translate one language into the other. You can talk about the brain, or you can talk about purpose and meaning, but you can't talk about cause and effect of the brain causing purposes and meaning. That's called an explanatory gap.
Right. And so I'm so frustrated all of the time because you it's not ordinary to find a medical doctor like yourself who will speak out against psychiatry and say that they don't know. And then this other end of it. What's that been like for you, being a person who has consistently spoken out against psychiatry?
Well, it's like being a hero and a martyr at the same time. You pay a high price for going against the establishment, but I'm willing to pay that price for honesty and for the sake of the people who are suffering at the hands of psychiatrists. So I feel good about what I'm doing, and I think what I'm doing is logically defensible and morally and ethically defensible. So I'm willing to take whatever they got to shoot at me. At my age, I don't care anymore anyway.
And for people who weren't listening earlier, I missed it a little. How may I ask how old you are again?
How old are you?
82.
82. So a world of change you've seen throughout your life, and you've consistently been in many different ways fighting for freedom, and this idea that you were just talking a little bit about before in terms of spirituality and suffering as a piece of it. Will you talk a little bit more about what suffering means for people, and if you could recontextualize those in society who might have only gotten the other message about psychiatry, can you talk a little bit more about suffering and overcoming it or getting accepting it?
Yeah. Well, suffering is the feeling of lacking what we want. It's a feeling of lack, of absence, frustration.
How you overcome it?
By willing to let go of what you want but can't have. We all do that. Go shopping at the mall and we look at things that are too expensive and we wish we could buy it but we can't. We don't have the money, so we let go of it. Or we want a car that's bigger and better than the one we have, but we don't have the money, so we let go of it. So we have to learn how to let go of things that we want, but we can't have. And we have to learn how to endure the suffering that we don't want, but can't avoid. So it's a matter of mind training. Buddhism is a course of mind training. It's not a path for the faint-hearted. It's a difficult path.
Because in some ways you have to embrace the suffering, right?
In some ways, you have to embrace the subject.
You don't have to embrace it. It'll come by itself. I mean, you have to be willing to endure it.
Endure
it.
Okay. Okay, that's a better word, endure than embrace. That's a better word. Okay, good. Thanks. So, over the years of your teaching, when you would get young students in front of you who were getting this other message from all of the other professors, likely, what would you say to your students?
Over the years of teaching young students who obviously at some point heard the other side of things, how did you approach that?
I would tell them to educate themselves and read some books. Psychiatrists are very uneducated. They don't read anything. But psychiatry and psychiatric literature is dumb. There's nothing worthwhile in it. I don't read psychiatric journals or any psychiatric stuff. It's all crap. The Jews have a saying, crap is crap.
And to not rely on it, I find it fascinating since I have to use their, you know, their books to teach Introduction to Psychology, for example, how they spend, the entire first 12 chapters insisting that it's science, and then all you get is maybe, probably, you know, someday. and yet they're still positioning it as they have the answer, and it's destroying all of these young people who are going into it because they think they're going to be able to assist people in getting the lives that they want. And I watch them getting brainwashed over from freshman to senior year. Did you see that as part of the problem of the education and the education materials in the field?
Talking about the students are being brainwashed with the information that it's a medical condition. How would you approach that?
I would say thinking that way is like thinking if somebody comes in and says they have a broken heart, you don't give them an EKG. It's a metaphor.
Right.
You have to understand how language works. The only way to describe the mind is metaphorically, because we can't observe it directly in other people. When we talk about mental illness, we're not talking about other people's minds. We're talking about the way they talk and the way they act, not about their minds.
Right. But you're not only you're also offering people like solid alternatives to another way to look at the situation, and I'm just looking if you could so you have this book Vinegar into Honey, 7 Steps to Understanding and Transforming Anger, Aggression, and Violence. Can you talk a little bit about that book?
Talk about Vinegar into Honey.
Okay, Vinegar into Honey is about anger, aggression, and violence. Now, when you go back to what I said earlier, that our suffering is due to wanting things that we can't have, anger is part of the fight-flight reaction. When we feel that we're in danger, we either fight the danger or flee from it. But the dangers for humans are not tigers and animals. The dangers for humans are not getting what we want. And when we don't get what we want, we feel frustrated. And we feel like we're in danger. If we can't get what we want and we have to experience what we don't want, that's a dangerous situation. So we become angry even though there's nothing to fight. It just makes us feel powerful to be angry. Well, anger is a power emotion. So just getting angry gives a feeling of power that overcomes the feeling of helplessness to get what we want or avoid what we don't want. That's the basic stuff, getting what we want and avoiding what we don't want. If we can't do that, that's danger, and we respond to danger with fight and flight. The fight is anger, the flight is anxiety.
Everybody should hear what it is you're saying. And so the same way that the expectation of what somebody wants or doesn't want will cause sadness or depression, that when you are in this other situation of having another kind of expectation about the way thing of what you want or don't want, then this anger or anxiety, fight or flight, responds. So, can you give people a little indication of what those 7 steps are?
What are the 7 steps? Can you tell a little bit about them?
Well, the 7 steps are: first of all, you have to recognize that you're angry. A lot of people get angry and they don't recognize it. They call it moodiness. Teenagers are very famous for this. They're moody because they want to do what they're about to do, but they're not able to. So they're frustrated, and they feel anger, but they can't express it because there's nothing that anybody can do about it. They're still too young. So the moodiness is suppressed anger.
And, of course, I'm just thinking of this in terms of, you know, what a real root problem for the overwhelming majority of people involved with psychiatry of being abused or other, you know, kinds of things that wind you up involved with psychiatry in the first place. The trauma response is always described as fight or flight, right? And that's what's going on because somebody feels helpless. So how do you rephrase for people helplessness in that way? Based on just what one wants. Like helplessness in terms of
helplessness. How do you rephrase helplessness?
Huh.
How do you rephrase helplessness?
Well, it's a feeling of wanting to do something, but you can't do it. Now, I've had a stroke, so I'm paralyzed on the left side. So I'm helpless to move my left side. But I can't move it, so I'm getting exercise. But if you want something badly, and helplessness is the inability to get what we want, no desire, no helplessness. Hopelessness and desire are the opposite sides of the same coin.
Hopelessness and desire are opposites. Okay. So it's desire and expectation so far, which are the problems?
Most people don't recognize when they're feeling helpless, especially men. Men don't like to feel helpless. Men are trained in macho, which means power. So if men feel helpless, they don't feel like men anymore. Men need helplessness training. Just like women have needed aggressiveness training or assertiveness training, men need helplessness training. We have to learn how to be helpless when we are. When we're helpless and there's nothing we can do, the best thing to do is to do nothing. And we have to train ourselves to do nothing. It takes a lot of training. It's like an Olympic training course, but of the mind.
And
the
so,
best way to explain helplessness to someone is to show them, point out to them when they feel it, so they recognize the feeling. They don't have to put it into words. You just have to recognize the feeling of the irritation and the feeling of powerlessness and the inability to control one's life, or maybe to control one's body or to control one's mind, or especially to control other people around us. That creates a feeling of helplessness, and it's a feeling that can be identified, and one has to identify the feeling, become aware of it. And second is that anger has many faces. It's not just explosive. Anger can be passive-aggressive. Anger can be a part of guilt. Anger can be just a moodiness, a grumpiness, and irritability. Though we have to learn to recognize all of those states as anger and analyze them. And then the next step is to recognize the feeling of helplessness and its relationship to what we want but can't get. And then we have to train ourselves to let go of what we want but can't have. That's very difficult for people to do.
What you want but can't have, right. And to somehow to let go of that. So psychiatry typically will say let go of that by giving you some benzo or something, right? What does a non-coercive psychotherapy, non-drug-based thing do to help somebody get to the point of letting go of it?
What does a non-coercive psychiatrist like yourself do to help someone let go of it?
Well, the best way is to teach them meditation, because when we're sitting in meditation, that's not easy to do. That's a discipline. You have to sit there and focus your attention on your breath. And when you want to get up, you don't get up. You sit there and you go through it. You do it with other people, maybe for a weekend at a time or a week at a time, and you learn how to manage your mind so that you're able to recognize your states of mind and to change your states of mind, to accept the unwanted and to let go of what we can't have. That's a training. It's like physical training, but this is mental training.
For a week at a time. So, okay, so most people may have a warped idea as to what meditation is. When you say meditation that could go on for a week, it's not something you do for an hour or something?
No, meditation is a style of life. It's not just sitting every once in a while. It's very intense. You have to. When I first learned meditation, my first teacher asked me to do it for 2 years, twice a day for 20 minutes for 2 years. And then when I got a Tibetan teacher, he asked me the same thing, twice a day for 20 minutes for 2 years before they would teach me anything else. So that's twice a day for 4 years just to get the beginning hang of it. And it takes a long time. It's not just meditating. It's understanding. It's developing insight into how the mind works. And when you have insight into how the mind works, the analogy would be if your car breaks down, if you don't know anything about the engines or how cars work, you can't fix it. Same thing. When you're unhappy and you don't know how the mind works, you can't fix it. So meditation is learning, becoming familiar with the mind. That's the best definition of meditation, becoming familiar with the mind, learning to know yourself. It's best to be done with a teacher who's done it and accomplished something. It's hard to do without a teacher. I've been lucky to have very good teachers.
And in your writings, you really, in all of your books, you really discuss this, and particularly in Vinegar into Honey. But I'm wondering about the another book. Again, we're talking with Ron Lifer, and you can go see all of information about him at ronlifer.zenfactor.org. And go on to the writings page of books and articles and all other kinds of publications. But you have this engagements with the world, emotions and human nature. That was published in 2013, and in the little blurb that I'm reading, it has the piece about William James. Who I'm as an environmental psychologist, I really appreciate what William James brought the world. And can you talk a little bit about what in because you know mental health programs use this. We're going to engage people. You know that's the buzzword these days in New York State anyway. We're looking at engagement, and I'm kind of sure it's not the same kind of engagement that they're talking about. Would you talk about your perspective of engagements with the world?
Talk about your perspectives of engagements with the world.
That's about emotions and human nature. Our emotions are rooted in human nature. The question is, what is human nature? And in this book, I give an explanation of human nature. As people have been thinking about that for a long time. The problem is that human and nature seem like opposites. We think of nature as the non-human, air and sky and earth and animals, and we think of the human as higher forms of consciousness like music and philosophy, thinking. But so human nature is a matter of understanding how we're similar to animals and how we're different than animals. We're similar to animals because, like animals like us, they go after what they want and they avoid what they don't want. That's the method for survival. Animals instinctually fitted to go after what preserves life and perpetuates life and to avoid what negates life and damages life and causes death. And we humans are doing that too. Except we do that also in the area of mind. So we're both like animals and unlike animals. And when we understand that, then we can approach the emotions. And in this book, I talk about all the emotions that get in the way of our happiness, like anxiety, anger, depression, guilt, shame, envy. And when we understand those, we're able to work with them a little bit more skillfully and overcome the pain of these negative emotions.
I think that's so urgent in terms of that, and that it comes back to this issue of seeking pleasure, avoiding pain, in terms of that, going for getting what you want as opposed to what you don't want, and how that all ties in. Do you know that William James was one of the founders with Clifford Beers of the National Committee on Mental Hygiene in the early 1900s?
Did you know that he was involved in the National Committee of Hygiene?
Huh?
Did you know that William James was involved with the National...
It was the National Committee on Mental Hygiene, today's Mental Health America.
The National Committee on Mental Hygiene. Did you know that he was involved in that? Well, tell her. He's getting a little tired.
Oh, okay, okay. Okay, so I'm just wondering.
For a long time, until recently, psychology was a part of philosophy. William James was a philosopher, but he focused on mind. He believed that mind was an organ that evolved to help us solve the problems of living. And that's the way I view mind. It's an organ which helps us to solve the problems of life. And
yeah,
what we call mental illnesses are problems in living.
Right, right. And he spoke out against patient abuse in a letter that I read of his to Clifford Beers, I really appreciate that, and so I'm just wondering, especially if you're getting a little tired, do you have other things that you would like to talk about or tell people?
Do you have other things you'd like to talk about or tell people? Because she knows you're getting tired.
Well, I would like to say to your audience, if anybody's listening, you're welcome to email me at ronleifer@aol.com. R-O-N-L-E-I-F-E-R, one word, @aol.com. And I will answer your mail, and we can have a discussion about what you're interested in. There's so much to talk about.
There is so much to talk about, and I want to really thank you for taking the time to talk with me tonight and to our listeners. There are a couple of people online, and so I'm not told anybody who's online, your lines are open if there's anything you'd like to share or ask.
She was asking if people online wanted to ask any questions, but I don't hear anybody.
Okay, I'm not hearing anybody either, but sometimes people just like to listen, so I don't want to put any pressure on anyone. But I want to thank you so much for joining me, and perhaps this can be the first of many more, because you have another book on the market now, right, Bemouth, that's just recently come out?
The most recent book he has is Engagements for the World. Your most recent book is Engagements, right? Yes.
I've written a couple of other books, but I haven't published them yet. I'm trying to publish them.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought I saw digital stuff, but it's earlier things. Okay, so great. So Engagements of the Mind. And anyway, I still find such value in the way that you are presenting another story, another thing that could be told to people, especially in trying to help people better understand the way that psychiatry medicalizes these very human experiences, and a way maybe that an alternative thought process could better meet that. And so I want to thank you for your work that you've done and for talking with me tonight.
Thanking you for the work that you've done.
You're very welcome. We've just skimmed the surface. But as I say, if anyone wants to discuss with me over the internet, I'd be happy to do it. My address is ronleifer@aol.com.
Great. Thanks. And so if there's anything else you want to add, otherwise we'll call it a night for tonight.
If there's anything else you want to add, otherwise, just said we're done.
Not at the moment. Okay. I think I have your email address. I'll send you some essays that expand on what we've talked about, and you can feel free to distribute them.
Thanks,
send
Ron. You know
email.
I...
Send me an email at ronlife@AOL.com, and I'll have your address, and I'll send you some of my essays that I'm working on now that expand on what we've talked about.
Great. I will do that. I will do that. And so other people can also, what a generous offer, other people can also email you at ronlifer@AOL.com, and I'll make sure to put those links up on Facebook and on the page to get it out there. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, and I look forward to future conversations in the future. Everybody else, I hope you have a great night. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll talk soon. And Heidi, thanks so much for helping out there.
You're welcome.
Good night, everyone.
Thank you.